All right, we are live with Alexander Mercouris. Alexander, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, very excited to be with Professor Sachs again.
Great to be with you guys.
Is always great to have Professor Sachs with us, and we have a fascinating discussion lined up today. So let's just jump right into it. A quick hello to everyone that is watching us on all the platforms. A quick hello to our moderators as well. Thank you for everything you do. Alexander, Professor Jeffrey Sachs. I have all your information in the description box down below, and I will add it as a pinned comment as well. Let's talk about the campus protests and Biden's policy around the campus protests. Alexander,
Well,
Jeffrey
I think
Sachs, let's begin.
let's begin indeed. And since we've got a relatively short time, I hope Professor Sachs won't mind if we plunge straight in, because it seems to me that Biden's policy is what ultimately lies behind the campus protests. And I, of course, my memory extends back to the 60s and early 70s. I can remember when young people in the United States and the universities came out to protest another war, which the United States had been drawn into. We know about the cynicism and corruption of decision making that led to that particular war. I am, of course, referring to Vietnam. I remember all the protests then. I have memories of what happened at Kent State. It's starting to look a little like that again. I should say I was watching with fascination the program that you did re recently with Chris Hedges discussing Kennedy and other things of that kind. Fascinating program. It all brought that all back together. And here we are in the United States, young people again protesting, worried about war, concerned about what is going on with an American ally in the Middle East. That is the focal part of the protests. And again, authority reacting with extraordinary force and incredible abuse as well. I mean, every day I'm reading things in the media, which I have to say I find absolutely shocking what they're saying and about these protests. But anyway, it all brings it all back. But of course, it's needed now, in my opinion, far more even than it was then, because the situation is so much more dangerous. Anyway, that's just my quick lead. Professor Sachs, over to you.
You have it exactly right. The students were right with Vietnam, and the students are right with Gaza and Palestine. They're protesting political actions of the worst sort by the United States. The U.S. and Israel are essentially together committing a genocide. We'll probably have that definitively determined by the International Court of Justice when it makes its ruling, which could come sometime in the coming months. The court has already said that there are plausible grounds for believing that Israel is in violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention. And there is no doubt in any way that Israel is doing this daily with the support, and could not do it otherwise than with the daily support of the U.S. government, which goes out of its way to say that there are no red lines. Israel gets what it asks for, and the students are protesting, of course. But what is amazing to me, maybe it shouldn't be amazing. I find myself endlessly naive all through my life because I'm constantly amazed by things that I shouldn't be amazed by. But the crackdown is brutal. It is thoughtless. It is based on phony claims that this is about anti-Semitism on campus, and we have to stop the anti-Semitism, or that the police are being called into my campus at Columbia University and to dozens of campuses around the world to keep things safe, when, of course, there was no threat to safety of anybody by peaceful protests. The only threats come when the police come on campus, brutally arrest students and faculty, I should add, though the students have taken the brunt of this. And then every kind of falsehood is put forward by the administrators, by the police. And then we have these visitations by members of Congress. If you ever want to have a lower regard for politicians, nothing like watching them stir up added trouble. We had the Speaker of the House of Representatives make that urgent stop on the Columbia campus to bemoan anti-Semitism on our campus as a crackdown came of this brutal sort, twice ordered by the administration, with the New York Police Department arresting dozens and dozens of students on each occasion, the university peremptorily first suspending and then expelling students, and setting either the most arbitrary deadlines or not even announcing deadlines before calling in the police, as was the case on April 18. And it's happening, Alexander, all over the country, which also leads one to suspect that there's a lot of coordination and cooperation underway, because I personally would guess that this is not independent actions by dozens and dozens of universities, but lots of discussion about how to make these crackdowns and so on. It's rather shocking period, but the students are not stopped, and they are not being bowled over by this. They keep coming in larger and larger numbers. We're going to continue to have a very hot time of this as long as this genocide continues, and it looks likely to continue right now as long as the U.S. government continues to give it full backing, which it does.
Which it does. And I get to make a few quick observations. I mean, as I said, I remember the Vietnam protests, and I remember the crackdowns that happened on universities in connection with the Vietnam protests. And at that time, and I see no reason why it should be different this time, crackdowns like this were radicalizing. They radicalized more students. They made those students who were caught up in those crackdowns angry and upset, obviously frightened, but also angry and more sure that they were, that they were on the right side. And it caused protests in the end to spread and get stronger. And the other thing I remember from the 1960s and early 1970s is that, of course, if you start arresting students, if you start doing this kind of behavior against students, then it's not just the students themselves you radicalize, but of course students have parents and family, and they become concerned and they start asking questions as to why things are being done in the way they are. And I don't want to push this further, but I mean, I think this is a misguided strategy, because of course the problem is exactly the one you said. The problem is not what is going on in Columbia and in universities. It is what is going on in Gaza. Now, history sometimes rhymes, as we often hear. There was a Democratic Party convention in 1968 when the protests really began to take off. It happened in Chicago. We have a Democratic Party Congress again in Chicago. There's growing disquiet amongst a large proportion of the base of the Democratic Party. This situation seems to me an attempt to get this all under control, this crackdown, all under control, when in fact it could do the opposite and generate more protests, including embarrassingly at the convention itself or around the convention itself. And the administration itself doesn't have a plan about how to move forward. Now, the other thing I just quickly wanted to say, running on a bit, but we've had, as you said, the ICJ case, which is coming probably in the summer sometime. And we've had a case at the International Criminal Court, which is supposed to be under intense pressure not to issue arrest warrants, and has now issued a statement, unprecedented.
An amazing statement. Yeah, absolutely unbelievable.
Saying, saying that they are that they will not let them, that they will not accept if they are pressured in the way that they clearly are. So again, these are not really questions, but can you address some of the points I've said and maybe take this discussion further?
I think the key point is that what is happening in Gaza is completely illegal and completely outrageous, morally, politically, practically. The only possible outcome of it, if it continues this way, is a wider war in the Middle East, which would turn into a world war. I think many in Israel, among the leadership, want that. They clearly want to provoke a wider war. They have been not very subtle in trying to draw the United States into a war with Iran for many, many years. And the attack on the Iranian consulate last month and the follow-up was yet another attempt to draw the United States into a wider war. So we are on a path that's absolutely devastating. What is key, as you've been discussing and I've been discussing and I've been involved in the diplomacy at the United Nations, is that the U.S. and Israel are essentially completely isolated in world opinion, other than the countries that the United States can arm twist desperately to fall into line. Britain can always be counted on to at least abstain. If the United States says jump, Britain will jump to some level, no matter the pain and the disagreement within the British public on this. And that happened again. Where the dynamics are right now, of course, is that the world is saying we need this war to end and we need a state of Palestine as a member of the United Nations, period. 57 years onward after the 1967 war, and that means the occupation of Palestine by Israel and the apartheid regime that became increasingly brutal and that is the basis of why this genocidal action in Gaza is taking place right now. This has to end. And so as I'm sure listeners will recall, last month, the Palestine Authority revived their application for UN membership, which had been put aside by the United States demand back in 2011. Back then, that's already 13 years ago, the UN Security Council meeting as the admissions committee had said, you fit all the criteria. Palestine should be a UN member state. And the U.S. said, oh, God, yes, yes, we agree completely, but not now. Give it a little time. Take observer status. And this is the U.S. ploy, which is always put off any decision that is in favor of Palestine at the behest of Israel. And that means put off forever. So the United States back in 2011 convinced the Palestinian authorities, just take observer status, membership will come soon. Of course, membership never came. What came was a genocidal war instead. The Palestine Authority revived its application, which had never been dismissed. It was just adjourned, sine die, day, without a date, and they revived it last month. Suddenly, we see the whole world supports this. 140 countries. Now it's, I think, 143, if I have the count right, because new countries are joining, already have diplomatic relations with Palestine. And when this went to the Security Council, I thought for sure the arm twisting by the United States would at least hold Japan, Korea, close U.S. allies in line against the application. But no. They came out firmly saying, what else? What are we going to do? We have to move to an answer. So in the end, the vote last month was 12 to 1. 12 countries saying immediate membership of Palestine, one vetoing the United States, and two abstentions, the UK and Switzerland. When you have a veto in the Security Council. This now goes on an emergency basis to the General Assembly. It looks like there will be a vote on May 10 in the General Assembly for UN membership of Palestine. Now, what is Israel, what is the United States doing? It's arm twisting every place. It's doing whatever bribes, whatever threats it can make everywhere to try to keep the vote down in the General Assembly. It's also doing something which is, I think, we'll see, but I think part of the incredible U.S. naivete which has gone on with Trump and now with Biden, which is it's trying to cut a deal with the Saudis. Come on, just announce that you'll have diplomatic relations with Israel. We'll give you nuclear technology. We'll give you F-35s. We'll give you a military alliance. We'll do everything. Well, a lot of tempting things on the table. What they're saying to the Saudis is break with the rest of the Arab world, break with the rest of the world. Just come with us. We'll give you every goodie that you want. And what they're doing is what, of course, the UK and the US has done with the Arab world for 100 years, trying to divide it, trying to bribe it, trying to threaten it, trying to cajole it, to play the US game. I don't think it's going to work. But even last week, there was Jake Sullivan in Britain at an FT conference, speaking his usual nonsense, but saying, oh, we believe in a two-state solution. We think there should be a process. Isn't that nice? We think there should be a process, a pathway to help meet the needs of the Palestinian people. In other words, we think there should be a road to nowhere, never, anytime, because we are the firm supporters of Israeli negation of any real peace in the region. So here's where we are. We have a vote coming up. I think it will be May 10 in the UN General Assembly. We have an Arab League meeting in Bahrain scheduled for May 16. After the vote in the General Assembly, this will go back to the Security Council. Will the U.S. continue to be the sole stalwart for war, which of course has been the U.S. vocation all along, or will the will of the entire world community, ex-U.S. and Israel, prevail? It's pretty interesting because this is bleeding support for Biden. Trump will be worse, but how can anyone support Biden in this context? You have to have some minimum standard. Not only the other side is completely whatever on this, because I think with Trump, we have no notion, but unpredictability. With Biden, we have certain failure on this path, and he's losing support, certainly of anyone under 35. But actually, when I say that, because that's what the opinion surveys say, I get deluged with not so nice mail from older people saying, don't speak for me. I'm against him. This is terrible. I'm for Palestine. So there are a lot of older people that are absolutely on the same side. Biden is blowing any chance at all politically because the power of the Israel lobby to this moment remains dominant, even when a president is staring political defeat in the face within a few months over this. It's stunning to watch. So students and faculty being arrested, protests being violently put down, an administration isolating the United States diplomatically in the world, nonsense spoken by the government that it's going to divide once again the Arab people. I don't believe it. This is where we stand right now. Absolutely horrible to watch the real mass killing and deaths in Gaza, and then horrible to watch this political spectacle and this complete collapse of civil rights in the United States.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Just a few quick observations. Again, not really questions. But firstly, even if the United States gets its deal with Saudi Arabia, what difference is it going to make? It's not going to change anything on the ground in Gaza. We're still going to get the same policies, but implemented by Israel in Gaza, probably even more violently because they'll be more encouraged to do them. And that's going to provoke more protests around the world, put more pressure on the Saudis themselves. It's not going to solve problems. This idea that you can resolve the problem in the Middle East by cutting deals with Arab governments like the Saudi government, it's just been tried again and again and again. It hasn't worked. The problem, the conflict is still there because it is a conflict ultimately between peoples. And unless and until this is properly understood and accepted, and people work on that basis, then we're never going to get a solution to this problem. The second is, going back to that Security Council vote, when the United States blocked Palestine getting statehood, I have to say, I was absolutely horrified by what the US ambassador said over the vote, because basically the comment made was, we won't do this, we won't recognize the state of Palestine until there is an agreement, a negotiated settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. Which in effect gives the Israelis, the Israeli government, which is adamantly opposed to a Palestinian state, a veto over the entire process. They can always string out any negotiations which happen. They can always complicate them, add conditions to all of those things to keep this thing going indefinitely. And again, you are giving, you're essentially surrendering your own ability to make decisions on this question to another government which is hostile to the whole idea of a Palestinian state. I find that astonishing. The third thing is recognizing Palestine as a state not only would be the just and correct thing to do from a moral and legal position, but it would also, in my opinion, increase US leverage over Israel if there really is a desire to achieve peace. The fact that they are not doing that undermines whatever leverage they have over Israel. Again, that seems to me obvious. It is getting everything completely the wrong way round. So, of course, we're going to see more crisis and we're going to see more protests in the United States. And that is, for me, the single biggest change. Because up to now, in every iteration of the Arab-Israeli conflict, Palestinian-Israeli conflict that I can remember, US opinion has been solid in support of US policy with respect to Israel, supporting Israel. Today, it seems that is no longer the case. And I'm going to suggest that is the single greatest change, the most important change that we have seen, and the one that gives hope that in the future, we will start to see a change in US policy and a change towards actual peace in resolving this conflict. So I consider these protests in Colombia to be enormous, and not just Colombia, obviously, across the universities, an enormous and important sign and a crystallizing moment.
I think you've hit it exactly right on every point. And it's worth pointing out, if people are not aware, why is it so important to have this UN membership of Palestine, a state of Palestine, sovereign state recognized by the world community. The reason is that already going back to 2002, to the Arab Peace Initiative, and repeated since then, though not reported in our newspapers, par for the course, but repeated by the Arab League, repeated by the Arab and Islamic nations, again, last November in Riyadh after this latest spasm of murder and massacre broke out in Gaza, the Arab and Islamic countries, and by the way, this includes clearly Iran, which has said so repeatedly, are ready for peace based on two states, with Palestine being a sovereign state, borders 1967, according to international law, capital in East Jerusalem, and control over the Islamic holy sites. That's the bottom line. And peace can be made on this absolutely sound, fair, practical, achievable, within reach grounds. And so the whole claim, the meme, the mantra, endlessly, falsely repeated, there's no way to make peace, there's no one to talk to, they're out to kill us, all the rest, is plainly, blatantly falsified by the Arab and Islamic world. And they are the ones that can make the peace happen and will make the peace happen as part of a peace settlement. And the United States knows this. And Israel knows this. And the Israeli government knows this. They don't want peace. They want greater Israel. That's the problem. They're not looking for a practical solution. They're not looking for a fair solution. They're not looking for a just settlement. We are in the hands of extremists. We are in the hands of extremists that demand everything and have a lobby behind that. And those demands are what blocks the peace and threatens the world. Everybody gets it. Our students get it. The other 190 UN member states get it, but the Israeli government doesn't want it. That's the problem. That's why this vote is so essential. That's why the U.S. actions are so completely destructive, self-destructive of the politics, self-destructive of American interests, destructive of peace, all of it. But it's all predicated at the core on a fundamental irrationality of a radical extremist government in Israel, which has thought all along, we can get what we want. The U.S. stands irrevocably with us. We have all the power. Who's going to stop us? And so it's this mix of arrogance and extremism that brings us to this point. But the world is getting it. The question is, does Biden get anything anymore? Does he care? Jake Sullivan, not exactly the most sensitive barometer of global truth. He's the one, of course, who said last fall, the Middle East is more quiet than it's been in 20 years. The week before the explosion occurred, showing how completely out of touch with reality they are. This is the question for me. Will they finally wake up at this penultimate moment? The answer probably is no, I have to say, unfortunately, because we could have the same discussion about Ukraine. And what we see is more and more irrationality in the West, less and less ability to have any kind of reasoned discussion, factual discussion. It's just spinning fantasies right now. And when people don't like the fantasies, when you have leaders that have 20% approval ratings, 25% approval ratings, just close meetings, crack down, stop protests. This is the direction we're heading right now. Absolutely amazing.
I completely agree. Can I just very quickly add a few things and then just last words to Professor Sachs? The first is the point about negotiations, peace be unattainable. I'm sure, like Professor Sachs, I have been involved in many negotiations. I've mediated some. I've seen how even when the parties are enormously far apart or seem to be so, provided negotiations are conducted in good faith, solutions to even the most intractable problems eventually appear. The key problem is good faith. We have never had good faith negotiations at any point in the Middle East crisis, going all the way back to the 1940s. And by the way, we've also never had good faith negotiations over Ukraine, which is why we're in the crisis there that we are as well. But absolutely, if there are good faith negotiations, then all of these problems that people talk about, it's surprising. I've been surprised myself time and again how people who genuinely want to come to an agreement find solutions with each other. And I think that's a point that people never make. The second is about the administration. I don't believe there can be any possible chance of this administration doing anything that will create peace. I have followed them very closely. They say one thing, they do another. I think that this is an administration that always takes the maximalist position on anything. It, whenever it talks about wanting compromise, be it over Ukraine, Taiwan, the Middle East, Gaza, whatever, what they're basically doing is stringing us along. I've come to that conclusion. Many governments around the world have done. The Chinese complain about it. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the third is I think eventually there will be peace in the Middle East. I think there has to be, because there is no other ultimate way forward. And the sooner we start moving towards good faith negotiations, the better, and stop empowering these extreme elements, these maximalist elements, who, of course, because they're being empowered, they can always come back and say to other people in Israel, we don't need to negotiate. We can have it all because the Americans are behind us. The moment that ends, those people will diminish. That again is absolutely clear to me. So over you to Professor Sachs.
Yeah, just a word about good faith. You know, we are roughly one century into this conflict. It started in World War I, so it's a little more than one century. With the Balfour Declaration, Versailles, the British Mandate, and so forth. So we go back a century. There has never been good faith by Britain or the United States for one moment in this region. And the modus operandi has always been manipulate, divide and conquer, the most basic maxim of empire. And what the U.S. and Britain have never done is dealt honestly with the Arab world. There is an Arab League, there is diplomacy, there is Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Saudis, the Gulf Cooperation Council, and so forth. They get together. If we had true good faith negotiations between the United States, EU, by the way, the P5, because China and Russia can be absolutely helpful in making peace in this region, because there's no divide among the great powers, so-called, in actually desiring peace and in a sensible way. But what the U.S. continues to do is think it can game it, manipulate it, fake it, delay it. And of course, the Israel lobby is relentless in its pressure and, I think, its destructiveness of Israel's, even its survival, the way that things are going, if it continues this extremist course. So I just want to underscore good faith. Good faith means that the countries of the region are actually treated with respect, honesty, transparency, because everybody in the region has the same incentive for peace and the same view, which is two states living side by side in security and leave us alone. We have other things we want to do rather than engulf ourselves in endless war. So good faith would be the way to make it happen. I think you said it absolutely perfectly.
Professor Sachs, thank you very much again for your contribution. I'm going to hand over to Alex now, and thank you very, very, very much for all the wise and important things you've said.
Professor Sachs, 10 minutes to answer some questions. We have a lot of good questions.
All right, let's do that.
All right.
Okay.
a question comment from Mustafa. Israel government acts with incredible bloodlust. Is Israel lost all reason? In the past, I thought them as reasonable actors. Now I see them as monsters.
I've been visiting Israel now for 52 years on many occasions. Israel changed. It changed a lot. There was always, of course, demands that I didn't agree with and actions that I didn't agree with. There was a movement for peace in Israel called Shalom Achshav in the 1970s and 80s that I agreed with. The words in Hebrew mean peace now, not peace later, but peace now. And there were always important elements in Israel that didn't want peace now. They wanted settlements now. They wanted to delay things. But things changed in Israel. There is a difference of Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin from Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu. The leaders in the past, they wanted favorable outcomes, but they actually wanted a solution. Yitzhak Rabin died for that. He was assassinated by a right-wing Israeli extremist, perhaps part of a broader network. We don't know all of the details of that. But there's definitely a difference, in my view, between the Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres's of Israel's past and the Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, Gallants of Israel's present. One thing that happened was the settler movement. Now, the settlement started in the occupied territories already by the late 60s and early 1970s. When I first got to Israel in 1972 as a kid out of high school, it was explained to me that Israel was, quote, putting facts on the ground. It was going to make security arrangements by having settlements in key locations in the occupied West Bank. I thought, this doesn't sound so good. When you make facts on the ground, what you're doing is violating international law. You're creating a situation that's going to become conflictual in the years ahead. But Israel was pretty triumphant and pretty dominant in those days. But that settler movement became a religious extremist movement also. It changed culture. It brought some extremist rabbis to the forefront. It became a fervent messianic movement among hundreds of thousands of settlers and their families and friends. So suddenly, the biblical references became not just once in a while mentioned, but dominant. God gave us the whole land. Today in the United States, the police and the Congress pound on students chanting from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. But it is the Israeli extremists who are the ones literally saying, God promised us the land from the river, that is the Jordan River, to the Mediterranean Sea. The extremism in Israel came to view not occupation, but greater Israel as a redemptive, religious, nationalist, messianic cause. I think this is a lot to do with what has happened. That, of course, some Israelis said we have implacable foes. This is a matter of security. But a kind of messianism also became very important politically. And in Israel's fractured coalition governments, they play a disproportionate role. This is the Smotrich, who is the finance minister. Ben-Gvir is the national security minister. They're absolutely extremists. And they represent a view that is extraordinarily dangerous, extraordinarily extreme, extraordinarily preventing any kind of peace. So in this sense, Israeli politics and Israeli culture and society changed enormously over the past 30 years. And this is a major reason why we're in this dire disaster right now, because the real leaders of this slaughter don't even hide their words. They talk openly about ethnic cleansing. They talk openly about this being all of our land. They talk openly about never a Palestinian state. And their words are so vulgar and so clear that this is how South Africa put together its application to the International Court of Justice, because it wasn't hidden, this intentionality. It was way out there in the open. I sometimes think these ministers forget that even when they speak Hebrew in their rally, someone can translate that for the rest of us who don't speak Hebrew. But the words are clear. They're extreme. They are messianic. They are biblical in reference. Netanyahu famously also talking about Amalek and destroy every man, woman, and child, as a biblical text holds from more than 2,000 years ago. Well, come on. This is not how we're going to find safety and peace, but this became a very important part of Israeli politics today.
Akli says, will the European countries start distancing themselves from Israel? Lots of arm twisting, and Xi Jinping is now in Europe. Will there be more discussions?
A number of countries in Europe, in the European Union, that is, have said that they will recognize Palestine bilaterally. Spain has been actively promoting this, a number of others. I think that this is going to happen. The EU has said, don't take actions outside of us. We'll keep everything together. The US, as usual, is trying to dominate EU politics, and does so to a shocking extent, again, to the EU's complete harm in the case of Ukraine. And here it tries to dictate policies to Europe that are definitely not in Europe's interest. But a number of European countries, Ireland and Spain and many others, are saying this can no longer wait. And notice very importantly, that France voted for immediate Palestinian membership in the United Nations in that vote. So this already shows that there is no, certainly no ability of Brussels to keep a U.S.-based party line, as it were. This is breaking because it's so outrageous.
Lim says, to what extent is this fueled by the gas and oil in the West Bank and Gaza? Without Russian gas, the U.S. and Europe have agreed and planned pipelines from Israel.
I think it is probably true that every major crisis in the region for the last 100 years has had a bit of an oil and gas subtext. I don't think it's the main driver in this, but I don't think it's completely gone either. There's lots of gas in Gaza territory, in the Mediterranean, in what would be Palestinian economic waters. There are issues that date back now 40 years to where pipelines will land coming from the Caspian Sea. There's oil in the Golan Heights, where U.S. investors and Israeli investors played very dangerous games. It's amazing to me, over decades, oil and gas, generally, it's like in a big orchestra. They're always playing a little bit of the tune of this. I don't think it's the major driver, however.
You have time for two more, Professor Sachs?
Sure.
From Darren Alevi, always a pleasure to hear Professor Sachs. Has he any opinions on if the UK and US have a change of administrations, the impact it will have on the Middle East or the Ukraine conflict?
Well, you know, if there is a change of administration, there will be changes, but of a complicated sort. I support Jill Stein as candidate in the United States because she's the peace candidate. I think the most important issue in the world is peace, because we really are sliding step by step to World War III right now on multiple fronts, in Ukraine and spreading, in the Middle East and spreading, and in East Asia, over Taiwan, but now the whole South China Sea becoming increasingly militarized. Biden is an extremely weak president. Nobody's sure how much he still has it anyway. Mentally, he's too old for this. He's too infirm for this, and he's weak anyway. His team is extremely weak. With Trump, just to say, there is a pragmatic belief that and plausible that Trump would basically end the Ukraine war by saying this NATO business, we don't need it. Maybe. Although Trump at the very last moment, a couple of weeks ago, kind of gave the authorization vote for the $61 billion. As Alexander always says, who can figure out the Byzantine negotiations that underpin any of this? As an American, I can tell you, as a close watcher of this, I've worked in Congress, I've watched this, I agree with you. It's completely opaque because it's basically lobbying money and gamesmanship rather than principles all the way through. But when it comes to the Middle East, Trump had large financial backing by absolutely core Israel lobby leaders, the Adelsons, now Sheldon Adelson's dead, but his wife continues to be a large backer. Trump was absolutely trying this divide and conquer game. Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, talked about turning Gaza into fancy Mediterranean villas recently. God knows. And when it comes to China, Trump is absolutely beating the war drum on China. Trump is no safety in terms of global peace. No way. He will pick and choose differently, but he's not a candidate of peace. Biden is obviously not a president of peace. RFK, who I went to school with and been friendly with for 50 years. I wish that he had been the candidate of peace, but he got pulled into the rather rabid pro-Israel side, completely off base, in my view. I tried to tell him many, many times, didn't succeed. So we have one peace candidate that's going to be on the ballot in the United States. That's Jill Stein. That's who I'm supporting.
Rob M. says, the recent anti-Semitism law has made it illegal to say that Jesus was killed by the Jews. Do Americans realize that the Anglo-Saxon clan is no longer in charge, but a certain race with origins from the Middle East?
Well, let me just say, you know, in general, first of all, we shouldn't be passing laws in direct violation of free speech, of thought. We have laws against that that are actually, and a constitutional provision that's actually pretty good for society. We're pushing all of that to the wayside. Also, by the way, throughout Europe, it's stunning. Just the open crackdown on speech right now in general. This is not a U.S. phenomenon alone at all. This is happening throughout the so-called Western world, which had professed to have some standards about open discourse, deliberation, the public square, the importance of political rights and free political speech and so forth. So this is all going by the wayside. But you ask a different question as well, and that is, do the Anglo-Saxons know that they don't run the world anymore? A few of us know. I mean, not that I ever thought one should run the world, but no. in Washington, in the East Coast think tanks, where I have, in a way, lived and worked, because I've been a university professor for 44 years now, at Harvard and at Columbia University. They don't know yet. They're completely fixated on maintaining U.S. hegemony. It's almost a psychological thing more than an analytical or a power thing. There is a deep, deep psychological neurotic state, I would say, in the U.S. Oh my God, are we still in charge? Are we still the lead? Britain actually thinks it still runs the world through the U.S., I have to say. So Britain had this hegemonic aspiration going back maybe to Queen Elizabeth. Not the recent one. I'm talking about the original Queen Elizabeth, but really from 1800 to at least World War I, Britain ran a lot of the world, manipulated a lot of the world, controlled a lot of the world, dominated the finance, dominated the military, dominated the telegraph, dominated the rails, built a lot of the world, ran an empire that was truly global in an unprecedented way. And the U.S. picked up the baton, or thought it did, loved the expression, this is the American century, that Henry Luce gave to the American people, the publisher of Time Life back in 1941. He told the Americans what they wanted to hear. It's your century for the world. And by the way, that was 1941. And in the Council on Foreign Relations and in Washington and the other think tanks, they're saying, hey, we still got years to go. So they really, really believe it. Definitely Biden, who lives somewhere, I would say, around the 1990s in his imagination, believes it. And this is one of the most dangerous points. This is why we have all these wars, because the United States can't stop itself from believing it can dictate everything. And this is what you guys talk about daily so correctly, so powerfully. It is this gap between this, as I say, almost neurotic belief in the United States right now, and this fear of losing power, that if you're not number one, you're somehow in dire threat, that China's about to come and invade, just about the most preposterous idea in our world today. But it is the view, and it continues to be the view. And deep down, they're very worried. They know we're not quite in charge. What are we going to do? But maybe we can manipulate this. Maybe we can do this. We can still defeat Putin. We can still get NATO enlargement. We can still show our way in Taiwan. This is why the world is so dangerous right now, because of this neurotic view, this gap between belief or wanna believe and reality, that if we don't open our eyes and restore rationality, all of these extraordinarily dangerous events are going to become even more violent and even more inclusive of the rest of the world.
Professor Sachs, can you answer one question?
I'll try.
Related to the statement from Joaquin Jeffries. This is from John Ski. I think this is an interesting question that I would like to hear your thoughts on. According to Jeffries, leader of the Democrats in the House, the U.S. will send troops to Ukraine if the Ukrainian front collapses. Russia has responded by beginning nuclear missile forces drills. What are your thoughts with Jeffries' recent statement?
Look, I don't think we're going to come to that. But then again, I generally underestimate irrationality, even insanity. The American people would absolutely oppose that across the board. Every political party, of course, young people, it would turn this country into turmoil. It would be the most reckless and dangerous thing. And yet, And yet we have President Macron doing this, saying it and apparently doing it. So nothing is impossible. As stupid and dangerous and wrongheaded as it could possibly be. Nothing is impossible right now. And so this is why every single day I say to as many leaders as I can, negotiate now. Don't put this off. There are so many stupid, dangerous, explosive ideas lurking that you can't just wait and hope that it comes out okay. I want Biden to pick up the phone, and I've said it every day since February. I've said it actually in January, December 2021 to Jake Sullivan, and I will say it every day publicly. Pick up the phone, call President Putin, and say that whole idea about NATO and Ukraine was stupid. Let's make peace, because that could bring about peace in a day.
Mr. Sachs, what happens to the euro if BRICS is able to create a currency to rival the euro or the US or the USD? Final question from Andres Versitz.
The BRICS process is happening. I support it, by the way, for a number of reasons, but it's going to take years. So this is not an imminent announcement from all I know. But the dominance of the US dollar, I believe, will decline markedly, even within a decade. Most of my colleagues disagree with me because macroeconomic history says there's a long, long historical tail to the role of, in other words, a long fading out of, say, the pound sterling and so forth. I think it's going to happen faster for geopolitical and technological reasons. If the U.S. and Europe insanely confiscate Russian assets, this will accelerate all of this dramatically. It's such a mind-bogglingly stupid, illegal, harebrained idea. I can't even describe all the things wrong with it. But this would also be extremely destructive of the international financial system as we have it right now. Suffice it to say, the renminbi will play a much larger role. There could well be if not a BRICS currency, a BRICS monetary arrangement, which gives a substantially increased role to several BRICS currencies. There could be a BRICS SDR kind of arrangement, done perhaps more ambitiously than the SDR at the IMF. But it's going to take some time to happen.
Professor Sachs, thank you so much for answering so many questions. We really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you on the show. Again, I have all your information in the description box down below, and I will add it as a pinned comment. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Take care. All right. Wow. Alexander, your mic. Yeah.
I think I'm here. Yes, I can hear you. I think you can hear me.
Great. Yes. Great show. We got a full hour from Jeffrey Sachs.
We got a full hour, yes.
let's answer the remaining questions. Bjorn, welcome to the Durant community. Dennis, welcome to the Durant community. Let's see here. Grassy Knoll, thank you for the super sticker. Johan, thank you for the super chat. Manveer says, excellent discussion. I just heard Belgium is considering trade sanctions against Israel. Do you think the Europeans are finally taking a stand against Israel's aggressiveness?
I can't understand how Belgium can do that by itself, given that it is a member of the European Union. As I understand, trade sanctions would have to be enforced and carried out and agreed by the entire European Union. Because remember, trade policy is something that the EU controls. So I don't think Belgium can just do it. It would have to come to some kind of agreement with other countries and get the EU leadership to agree. Maybe that's what that's all about. I don't know.
Jungle Jin says the ICC succumbed to pressure in indicting Putin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they did. Absolutely. And I mean, it's a, I've discussed that decision many times. And I've said it's legally illogical. It makes absolutely no sense, especially given that, as I understand it, there has been every single case where parents have asked to be reunited with their children, there has never been a problem. At least there may have been problems, but they've always been resolved, and the children have ended up being reunited with their parents. Now, I ought to say, when I was working at the Royal Courts of Justice decades ago, I was heavily involved at that time in child abduction cases. I was, you know, I had to deal with all kinds of cases where children had been abducted and taken overseas and brought home and all of that. This is nothing like this. This case makes absolutely no sense at all. It really doesn't. It's an absurd case from every single point of view. So, I mean, I know a bit about what I'm saying, but yes, whether they will be able to withstand the pressure in terms of warrants against Israel, we'll just have to see.
Andres Spersen says, the Biden White House has no clear direction. How can the leaders be so bad with the withdrawal of Afghanistan, the Ukraine war, and now Gaza?
Well, they can, and they are. And I mean, you have to understand that this is the product of the current political process in the United States, which has become profoundly and disastrously dysfunctional. And it's also the product of the fact that power within the United States, to a dangerous degree, is controlled by a small neocon faction that works in private and which has the support of elements of the deep state and of the financial oligarchy.
GI1416 says, why did the U.S. try to calm the Israelis after the Iranian retaliatory attack? Wasn't this the opportunity the neocons hoped for all along?
I think they did, and I think a lot of them were very angry about it. But I think the reason it was done was because the United States has its arms full, is full with Ukraine. It's trying to get some way of trying to stop the military disaster playing out in Ukraine. And they realized that an all-out war between Israel and Iran, which would bring in the whole of the Middle East, was just one crisis more than they could cope with at this time. But to reiterate, it's been deferred. It's not been cancelled. And the more we learn about the Israeli strike on Iran, the clearer that is.
Christos says, pathway for peace is just talk, no action.
Well, at the moment it is.
Bob, thank you for that super sticker. Kobe says, calling Anthony Blinken blinkers, no reverse gear.
True enough.
Oscar says, what happened in Gaza is like Warsaw uprising in 1944. They stood up against a violent regime that kept them in a ghetto.
Yes. I think it was in 43, actually, if I'm right, but I'm probably getting it all wrong. Remember, there were two uprisings in Warsaw. One, which is the one that you're referring to, which took place in the ghetto. And then there was the second one that took place in August 1944, which was organized by the Polish resistance. And people often conflate them, but they're two quite separate events.
Vincent Vega, welcome to the Dran community. Matthew says, similar to your thoughts on the Middle East, do you think peace in Ukraine is inevitable? It seems we have to be right on the edge of a cliff to act.
I think not, I'm afraid. I think here the crisis is actually in some ways less intractable because the advantage possessed by one side is so much greater. So I think what's going to happen in Ukraine is that the Russians are going to win their victory, either probably next year or the year after, who knows, but they're going to win their victory and they're going to dictate terms. I think it's as simple as, I think that we will have peace, but it will be peace according to the Vietnam scenario, which ended with a North Vietnamese victory. I think it's going to be the same in Ukraine. The Middle East is very different. Carry on.
Can I add one thing on top of what you just said? And I think they're going to blame it on China. I think the West is going to blame a lot
Absolutely. I mean, that there was that incredible article in the Wall Street Journal about Biden being angry that the Chinese have crossed his red lines. It's all China's fault.
Yeah, let me just real quick, and we'll get back to the questions. Let me just read you an article here. China causing deindustrialization in the European Union, says von der Leyen. They're going to blame everything on China.
Everything, yeah.
Deindustrialization, that's our term. That's your term. Tony Vaz says, thank you for the incredible work. Finally caught a live show. Thank you, Tony. Mm-hmm. Great. Super chat. It's an honor to have you with us. Sustain F, thank you for that. Super chat. Eric Hatchett says, lovers of self have brought all this mess about.
Yes. Absolutely.
Iradian Kiddo says, great show as always. Brad Arnold says, Larry Johnson says the U.S. is the biggest sponsor of state terrorism in the world by far. Do you agree?
Well, he is the expert on this. He used to be the CIA's point man on the subject of terrorism, so he should know. Who am I to disagree?
Duck Life says, if the U.S. just invested all their military dollars into their own country, it truly would be the shining city on the hill.
Yes, absolutely. That is what makes this whole situation so tragic. Every day, from Americans, I hear stories about the dire state of American infrastructure, about the condition in the cities, about the explosion in the crime rate in various places. I hear about shuttered businesses, communities under pressure, about people not being able to pay their bills because prices are rising, about mortgage costs. I hear this all the time. And if the US pursued a policy of peace and internal construction, as it once did, you know, that was what brought us to the point where the talk of the American century became possible. Well, I am sure that we would be looking at a completely different United States.
Here's a question that I know you have the answer to, Alexander. Fanny Bunny says, gentlemen, what do you think Israel's reaction should have been after the 7th of October attack on Israel? Do nothing or ask for a resolution somewhere? You've actually outlined this in detail on many shows.
In many, many places. But let me repeat again. The right thing for Israel to have done after the events of 7th October was to go to the UN Security Council. Now, at that time, it had overwhelming support and sympathy in the Security Council. The Chinese and the Russians loathe Islamist terrorism. The United States and the Western powers would have backed it. The Arab states do not like Hamas. Egypt is in conflict with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, of course, Hamas is a splinter group from that. So is Syria. Syria dislikes the Muslim Brotherhood, which led the uprising against President Assad, and Hamas forces fought alongside the insurgents in Syria. Saudi Arabia, for all kinds of reasons, loathes the Muslim Brotherhood. Collectively, the world was horrified. The Security Council would have been united. It would have had power to immediately insist that Hamas release all the hostages and make it would have declared the events of the 7th of October terrorism. It would have asked or ordered or required Hamas to to surrender its leaders who were involved in that event, to surrender themselves to international justice. And obviously Hamas would have opposed that, but it would have come under enormous pressure from across the Middle East and from the Arab world. And the Security Council, if there'd been defiance from Hamas, would have gone further and would have started to impose Chapter 7 sanctions closing down, legal sanctions, by the way, closing down access by Hamas to bank accounts, to financial operations, to all kinds of things, which the Arab states would have supported and would have implemented. And sooner or later, in the face of this overwhelming pressure, Hamas would have backed down. Of that, I have absolutely no doubt. That was the right thing for Israel to have done. Instead, they went for this war. We've seen the disaster that is playing out, and we now see talks sponsored by China between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority to form a united government. We see Hamas delegations visiting Egypt. We see Hamas, in effect, treated across the Arab and Muslim world as a responsible party. It was the biggest, most extraordinary, most terrible mistake that the Israeli government made to do what it did. But given the type of government it is, as Professor Sachs described it, it could not have made any other decision. The government, which ought to have stepped in and told Israel, do not do this thing. Go to the UN Security Council, which, by the way, under international law, you are required anyway to do. The government that should have done that was the United States government. Instead, what we got was Biden going to Israel and handing Netanyahu a blank check. And now we see where we are.
Death dealer 1341 says Macron is tripling down on sending troops to Ukraine.
Yes, he is. And that's why we're now getting nuclear exercises, tactical nuclear exercises by the Russians. And both Peskov and the Russian Defense Ministry have confirmed that, in effect, these exercises are made in direct response to Macron's comments.
Underhill says, what would you say to someone that says it isn't genocide, just war?
Well, I would say that first of all, genocide is a legal concept, and that it ticks all the boxes. If you want to argue otherwise, go to the International Court of Justice and try it there. The Israelis are doing it, and they're losing.
Darren Alevi says, do you think the UK-US special relationship will break apart if we see Trump and Starmer in power at the same time due to disagreement on NATO?
The British will be very, very unhappy if it breaks down, and they will move heaven and earth in Washington with their many friends there to try to preserve this connection, this relationship with the United States. I'm going to say something. I think that this relationship between the United States and Britain, whereby, exactly as Professor Sachs said, the British try to manipulate the Americans in order to satisfy their own urge to continue the fantasy that they're some great power. I think it has been a disaster for Britain. It means that we're centered. We think all the time about what the Americans are doing. We spend far too much time on our foreign policy. The fact that our country is in deep crisis at the moment is again, largely a product of this. And by the way, one person who started to see that very early on, you don't often hear people talk about this, was Churchill. Now, I'm not a huge, I got lots of queries about Churchill, and I'm far from being uncritical about him. In fact, I have many very strong criticisms to make against Churchill. I'm Greek, remember, and he messed up Greece terribly in the 1940s. But Churchill understood in the early 1950s that Britain was losing its freedom of action. It was losing control of its economy and society. And his priority, therefore, as Prime Minister, the last period of time that he was Prime Minister, was to try to end the Cold War so that Britain could start to operate more independently and more freely from the United States. And of course, he came against huge opposition within Britain itself, and he was pushed out of the premiership because of it. And that, ever since then, the situation has just got worse and worse and worse, and we are tied hand and foot to the Americans, who are tied hand and foot to us, and it hasn't worked well ultimately for either of us.
Cub fan says, does the Western leadership exemplify the Dunning-Kruger effect regards Russia and China and their belief in neoliberal economics?
I'm not sure what that is, by the way, the Dunning-Kruger effect. I've never heard of it, but regardless of that, I simply don't know what it means. But regardless, I mean, they have China, Russia on the brain. And again, the reason is for the one that Professor Sachs said. They are worried, they're terrified that things are slipping out of their control, that the hegemony is passing. They look at China with its enormous economy. They look at Russia with its tremendous resources. They look at the power of the Russian army, which they completely underestimated, and they're spooked out. And the result is that they're leading us down this absolute blind alley. And both our countries, both Britain and the United States, are going down this blind alley together.
Let me read you what the Dunning-Kruger effect is. The Dunning-Kruger effect is a cognitive bias in which people with limited competence in a particular domain overestimate their abilities.
Well, I think that describes the situation exactly.
Mm. Yeah, thank you, Cubfat, for that. Let's see. Tim Gibson, thank you for that super sticker. Moondragon says, seems like the U.S. wants troops in Ukraine. Is this a bluff?
I think people are reading more into Representative Jeffries' words than he actually said. I've looked at them, and you know, if you want to pass them, and by the way, I think he was talking without thinking his things through. He was basically saying the same thing that the Biden administration has been saying for some time. It was, you know, we've got to help Ukraine as much as we can, because if we don't and they lose, well, we'll have to fight them over here instead of helping Ukraine to fight them over there. I think that was the ultimate sense of his words. The real purpose of his comments, which people are missing, was that he was bashing Marjorie Taylor Greene and the Republicans, the House Republicans, who oppose more aid for Ukraine, by making out that they're some kind of fifth column carrying out the instructions of Putin. That was what he was really talking about.
Yeah. Let's see. Orion Watcher says a false flag might be on the menu.
Oh, yeah, always.
Garrett Riggett says, thank you, gentlemen. Keep on, from Germany. Thank you for that. Alaura G says, Zariel is moderator extraordinaire today. Thank you all.
Yeah.
Agreed. Thank you for that. Dana, thank you for that super sticker. Cub fan says, when will enough people in the Western world wake up and realize our emperors have no clothes?
Well, hopefully not fairly soon. I think a lot of people do see this, actually. We're probably going to do a dedicated program about this. But the local elections in Britain tell a very interesting story about how the British feel about their leaders, both Conservative and Labour.
Yeah, we will definitely need to do a dedicated video on that. Jungle Jin says, surely Hamas's legitimate armed resistance to occupation, had the inmates of Auschwitz broken out and killed Nazi guards and others, would that have been a terrorist attack? What's the difference?
Well, I'll tell you what the difference is for me, and I think it is a key one, which is that Hamas broke into Israel with the purpose of taking civilians hostage. Now, that is a war crime, and that is unequivocally a war crime, and is one that you can legally define as a terrorist act. I say that there is no proper, fully agreed definition of terrorism, but I would call that a terrorist act myself. Seeking to take hostages, accepting the fact that people will die, you're targeting civilians, you're abducting people, and that is wrong.
Danielle says, if the ICC collapses, would this have any implications on the indictment against Putin and for some of the other rulings made?
Well, if the ICC collapses, if it implodes, then of course Putin can't be indicted by the ICC because it would have collapsed. It would no longer exist. I don't think it will come to that. I think the ICC will continue to function in some form. And even if it is collapsed, I have to say this, I think all that you will see is that the indictment will be transferred from the ICC to some other court, even a national court, you know, the British court or something of that kind.
Yeah. diminished ICC. Raphael says, Valley S, best moderator of all times. Thank you, Raphael, for that. Zahir, thank you for that super sticker. And one sec, one more. John Ski says, why does Europe, Poland in particular, think China has control over Russia for stopping this war? U.S. wagging their dogs.
Well, this is it. I mean, they because they've internalized this narrative that Alex talks about so correctly, that it's the Chinese who are enabling Russia to win. I mean, this is their explanation now. They believe that. They've come to believe that themselves. So they say to themselves, well, you know, if the Chinese are helping Putin win, it means that the Chinese can stop him. Now, I say that, of course, there's some who are even more cynical about this. They're using this whole narrative to bash China even further. They say that because the Chinese are not stopping Putin, that proves that they are these evil people who are hostile to us and are trying to destroy us. And, you know, there are some people like that. But I think there are also fools who believe it because, you know, it's out there, and who therefore have come round to the view that it is, in fact, the Chinese. The Chinese have all this leverage over the Russians. And it provided we can, you know, get the Chinese to agree, we will win the war in Russia, and this terrible man, Mr. Putin, will fall and we'll get regime change and be able to break up the country and do all of those things that we've always wanted.
Yeah, it's actually quite a clever cope. I didn't see the whole Chinese are to blame thing coming. Came up with a clever excuse. It serves a lot of different purposes. Yeah,
that is the one skill these people have. They are empty. I mean, they can't produce shells, but they can produce excuses. They can do this. They can do this to infinity, it would seem.
Yeah, they still have that skill. Jungle Jin says, so such a postulated Auschwitz breakout would have been a terrorist attack.
No, I mean, I said it's not. If Hamas had broken into Israel and attacked Israeli military facilities, that would not have been a terrorist attack. If just as people breaking out of Auschwitz and fighting the guards in Auschwitz would not have been a terrorist attack. But going out and seizing hostages, which is what Hamas tried to do, that is a terrorist act. I mean, that I think that there is, well, at least it is a war crime. And as a war crime, because it targets civilians, I think there is a very strong case for saying it's a terrorist act. The two are different.
Yeah, Raphael says the USA will give Alaska to Russia before they go to war. Do you guys realize that all banking sanctions are lifted on Russia dealing with energy until next year?
Oh, yes, I've seen that. Exactly. Which makes a complete nonsense, by the way, of a headline that was there in the Financial Times, which was saying that, you know, the fact that the West has tightened the financial sanctions on Russia is actually causing the Russian government invisible cash flow problems. I say invisible because I can't see where these cash flow problems are. But the reality is they're not tightening the sanctions. They're softening because they don't want oil prices, energy prices to rise further before the November election. This is what this is all about.
Yep, I agree with you there. Alexander, let me just do a quick check to make sure we got all the questions. From Elsa, is there a way for the ICC to take the arrest warrant against Putin back legally and as a chance to survive?
Oh, absolutely. Of course they can. What they can do is they can put it before another judge, another panel. The judge is perfectly entitled to say, look, I've just looked at all of this. This case is unworkable. And they can cancel their own indictment and drop their warrant. Courts can do that. They do that often. They won't do it because this isn't an indictment founded on law. It's an indictment founded on politics.
Yeah. All right. That is everything. Your final thoughts, Alexander, and we'll wrap it up.
That's absolutely brilliant. Live stream again with Professor Sachs. I come back to what I said. I think this is a crystallizing moment. The fact that we now have protests coming started to happen in elite universities amongst students who clearly, we're talking about people from drawn from the top tiers of American society and young people and all of that in the United States. It's not, by the way, just about Israel. It is about forever wars. People don't want them anymore. And remember what Professor Sachs said. If there's ever any question of sending American troops to fight the Russians in Ukraine, the entire country will be turned upside down. And every single opinion poll I've seen coming out of the United States confirms that.
Here's a question from Life of Brian Alexander that was asked during the last live stream, which came in as we signed off. We always get a question that comes in as we sign off, but let me read it to you right now. Life of Brian said, two Boeing whistleblowers now meet an untimely demise. How do we look at the clearance class, the class that can be openly criminal? That's the choke.
I ought to say that, as is always the case, I'm going to be very careful before jumping to conclusions about how those whistleblowers came to die. But let's put that aside. The fact is that the whole whistleblower thing in the West is a complete nonsense. Whistleblowers are being oppressed, rounded up, jailed all the time. All of that is being suppressed constantly. The only time when whistleblowers are protected are when they're helping to impeach Donald Trump. So that's all I can say about that. About Boeing, there are other people who are better able to discuss these things than I can, because I don't understand the technical and industrial problems. But it seems to me that Boeing is simply going through the same kind of malaise that company after company, industrial group after industrial group across the West is doing. But about whistleblowing, about that doesn't exist anymore. We had that program with Aaron Maté last week, in which Aaron made the point, what about the whistleblowers of the OPCW? What's happened to them? We've forgotten, we've completely ignored, suppressed all discussion about that. They've been driven out of the media. They can't express their views. People are no longer being told anything about them. So whistleblowing as such has gone alongside the right of free speech and, by the way, the public interest defense, which is also being whittled away to non-existence.
David says, so according to Poland, I have to blame China for traveling Putin for losing my school homework. Traveling Putin for losing
of course, homework. Of course. That's absolutely right. I mean, China is to blame for absolutely everything. I think you need to understand that. They are responsible for everything that goes wrong. If the dollar goes down too much, that's China. If it goes up too much, that's China. If a factory closes, that's China again. If prices rise, that's also China. China is to blame for absolutely everything that happens in all parts of the world, and especially the West.
Yep, that's the new narrative. Yep. All right, we will end it there. Thank you to everyone that watched us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Rumble, YouTube, and the awesome Locals community, theduran.locals.com. Thank you very much to our moderators, Valies. Thank you, Zariel. Thank you, Gift of the Gab. Thank you as well. And I think that is everybody that was moderating for today's live stream. Thank you once again to Jeffrey Sachs. I have his information in the description box down below. I will add it as a pinned comment. Alexander,
good live stream. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant live stream. And thanks to everybody, to those also who asked us such very good questions over the course of it. And always any live stream with Professor Sachs is one of the best.
Let's get back to work now. All right. Take care. Take care.